My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest is a former paratrooper whose experiences during and after Afghanistan are shocking, brutal, yet remain uplifting. He's a husband, a dad, and a world champion mixed martial artist. Sometimes the hardest fights are on the battlefield or in the cage. Sometimes they're within ourselves. Episode 2, Terry Brazier. This is Declassified. Terry, mate, it's an absolute privilege having you here, especially it's only a few days before your second world title fight. So how are you?
Yeah, good. Feeling good, prepared for my fight, cutting weight at the moment, so I'm looking skinny and full of water. I'm good.
How's it feeling though?
Yeah, not too bad. Obviously, it's my second world title, so it's super exciting. First time cutting down to 70 kilos. Probably the first time I've been 70 kilos since I was about 12 years old. So, I like a challenge.
Well, you know what? That leads us on, because we're going to probably start and finish there. But before that, you mentioned being 12 years old. I want to take you right back to childhood. And what was life like as Terry Brazier growing up?
I grew up in that era where probably our parents' drinking was a big part of society. A lot of time was spent down the pubs and in social clubs and things like that. So I grew up in and around that. My dad was actually an alcoholic, only at the stage where he got the choice of family or drink. He realised he was an alcoholic when he chose drink over his family. So I sort of grew up in that sort of lifestyle. Yeah, quite a rough childhood. Nothing down to my mum, really, you know, really loves family, sort of a mum side of things. But obviously the alcohol on my dad's side was rough.
Was it chaotic?
Yeah, it's chaotic. Yeah, really rough. You know, I used to hate him for it, but now I've got him to thank, because it's certainly toughened me up. The years of physical abuse and getting beaten up and having to fight a fully grown man when you're 13 years old toughened you up.
Was it a lot of violence?
Oh yeah, yeah, big time. Yeah, it's one of them. Alcohol's one of them things. When he was sober, he's the nicest bloke on earth, but he's probably sober about 3 hours of the day.
What area did you grow up?
Denham, which is just outside Uxbridge. I was born in Hillenden, grew up in Denham, little village. You know, like I say, everyone used to drink.
Yeah.
You know, down the weekend, the kids would be in the pubs even. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of that sort of lifestyle.
And then, was it an obvious path then to join up?
No, I got in a lot of trouble. Being in that sort of area, we, you know, like I say, grew up in the pubs, grew up around drunk blokes, basically.
Did you have role models? Sorry to interrupt. Did you have role models around?
No, not really. My granddad, but then I lost my granddad when I was quite young. He was into his hunting and his outside, you know, shooting. So yeah, that was good. But yeah, sort of growing up around that sort of rough lifestyle with my dad and stuff, soon turned to me being a little shit, basically. And throwing my own weight around when I was younger, fighting a lot of the older boys, and getting in a lot of trouble with the police and stuff like that in the local area.
So why did you join up then?
Because as I got older, the trouble got worse and more serious. I was actually in a lot of trouble. And I was on my way to court one day with my mum, and I didn't think I was going to come back that day. And she made me promise that if I got away with it, that I'd change my life. And I promised, because I didn't think I'd get away with it, to be honest. I thought, I'll probably see you in a couple of years. But I got away with it that day and got the train to Wembley careers office the next day. And when I just signed up, Sam Wainpat. Sampat. That's it. Wayne Sampat.
Yeah, you got that.
I got there in the end. And he signed me up that day. And then normally you've got a waiting process of paperwork and stuff like that. And he got me in like 20 days later.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was in Catterick 20 days later.
So the courtroom to Catterick in 21 days. And so are you a man that keeps your promises? Because there you've
100% to my mum, though, yeah. Yeah. I lost my mum about 4 weeks ago, so five weeks ago, just for my last fight. But I had a great relationship with my mum. Because of the crap relationship with my dad, it brought me and my mum really close.
And
she's wicked.
Was she proud of you when she
joined up? 100%, yeah. Couldn't make her any more proud. Because growing up and the trouble I was in and the type of person I was, very boisterous, you know, always the front man. She was going to go either really good or really bad.
Yeah.
So for me to jump on the train and go and join the army, she was over the moon. Obviously worried about, you know, going on a tour and things like that.
Mm.
But she knew that was probably a better place for me than the streets.
Was you clever as a kid? Was you like...
Teachers didn't know how to teach me. Like academically, I was horrendous. Like, attention span of like a goldfish at school. But anything physical, I'd always win everything at school physically. Or you give me a problem and I solve it. But in terms of just pen to paper, I was useless.
So you joined, so you're in Catterick now, and then basic training for you was what was it? Did you thrive? Did you?
Yeah, basic training. My sister actually sent me a picture of a certificate that I got in training. Like I got best PT in training and things like that. I was like strong, I was fit. You know, steeplechases, I'd drag people through. Do you know what I mean? Like I was that guy, and I really found what I was good at. Like the army really brought that out of me, and that's where I thrived. I loved it, absolutely loved it. Always commander and things and exercise.
Mm.
I really found my place. They knew how to teach me.
Yeah.
Okay. Like at school, they didn't have the facility. They didn't, you know, I needed to be outdoors. I needed to be burning energy.
Was it the discipline or was it the routine or was it the
It's really
the,
weird
the
because
wear.
I've never been disciplined or able to discipline because I didn't really respect my dad. Because of that sense of like, you know, you could see what he was doing. I had a good relationship with my mum. She'd discipline me, but it was more just a friend relationship where she'd say, you know, I don't want you doing that, so I wouldn't do it. It wasn't really a discipline. Yeah, okay. And then when I joined the army and they started disciplining me, it just worked for me. Do you know what I mean? And I could see what they were trying to achieve.
Mm.
I won't be disciplined if I can't see a outcome at the end of it, or a good outcome, or something good come from it. Whereas in the army, I could see what we were trying to achieve, and doing as I was told, it would make a system work. And it just really worked with me.
Being really part of something, then.
That's it.
And really coming together, especially from that chaotic
start. Family,
isn't
it? Do you know what I mean? So, being part of that, and then seeing that me by me doing what I should be doing, everyone benefits. It just, you know, worked with me.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? How we can, some kids really get it academically, and some kids really want to be out there and with a purpose, and especially with the exercise involved, it keeps everything calm. And
I could see myself developing into a man, do you know what I mean? I joined when I was about 20, 21, and I just, that's when my mind was changing. I just see myself growing and as a person and just developing as a man, do you know what I mean? And it really worked well with me.
Would you think you was behind in that kind of development? Because I joined at 16 and I thought some of the corporals and whatnot actually helped bring me up and develop me in maybe a couple of years.
See, I was the other way around, where the sergeants I had, Sergeant Sheehy was my section commander, and he instantly identified that I was a leader, and I was quite boisterous, and because I was a bit older than the other lads, a lot of the other lads were 17, 18, 19, and I'd been and done and seen a lot. I left school early. I grew up, you know, I was in a lot of trouble with some big names in London and things like that. You know, I'd seen a lot by the time I joined the army, and they recognised that and put it to good use. You know, if something needed doing, they'd be like, Brazier, sort the boys out, and it was instantly done. Do you know what I mean?
Easy load for them as well.
Yeah. You know, I was setting up like underground boxing fights and stuff and training, and like, literally, like, really, you know, and that and the word got about. It's pretty much like prison, isn't it? Yeah. So let's be honest. Well, like training is like 7 months of prison. So.
It's an institution.
Yeah, and exactly. Yeah, let's put it that way.
They keep you busy, but there's sometimes where your mind can kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, and they just worked with me, and I got on with them, and to be honest, sort of become quite matey with them. To be honest,
yeah.
Some of them are still on my Facebook now. Before my fights, they're like, yeah, you know, like. I chat with them before my fights, and they send their best wishes. And
that bond can really be strong. And
yeah,
so you left. So basic training was finished. That good 7 months of that out. Then and then who did you join? What was your cap?
I joined the Irish Guards. Like I say, Wayne Sampat was Irish Guards, and he's from Hayes, and he knows I'm a local boy. So and they were based in Windsor at the time.
Yeah.
So I thought result. And I was with someone from Windsor at the time anyway, so it's sort of just the Irish Guards it was.
Did you adapt all right, you know, because you were a little bit older when you got to your
yeah,
regiment?
I loved it. I settled in. Yeah, within a matter of weeks, I was running things, so yeah. I felt good. I felt at home there. It was good. It was good to be part of something.
Did you enjoy, because I'll just take it back to my experience. I was big into kind of rugby league, rugby union, and that really got me involved with senior ranks and junior ranks. Did you get into the sport, or was it more soldiering for you?
It was more just soldiering. I just loved it. Absolutely loved it. I loved proving myself. I loved, you know, on a steeplechase, getting everyone on board and, you know, dragging a log on my own if I had to. You know, I loved praise. I still do now. My coaches, my MMA coaches, I've sort of learned that'll work really well with praise. And looking back, I really noticed that in the army. Do you know what I mean?
If that immediate
sergeants were talking about me, I'd be boosted. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And want to put in more effort next time. And to be honest, just got into the whole fitness side of things with my other mates, the soldiers that I was training with. I got right into bodybuilding, to be honest. Yeah,
did you?
Originally, yeah.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's then a kind of natural progression from joining your regiment, and then you wanted to seek something a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you want to take it from kind of peak up, pretty much.
I was in the Irish Guards, done Queen's Birthday Parade, done all the guard duties. Just didn't feel enough for me at the time, so I went for P Company, smashed P Company, and then found a different breed of soldier amongst the guys in Free Para. Definitely more the soldier I wanted to be over there, a lot more physical than the guards. The mentality was a bit rougher, a bit tougher. You didn't get as much trouble for fighting. So it's like, I suited Free
Power. You found your element.
Yeah, though. I found my element. Free Power is amazing.
How long was it? And we had a brief conversation yesterday, and I just want to, well, I want to let you roll with it, but I'll introduce it. And part of that kind of next section of the conversation, we're going to talk about some dates and times, and you explained something to me yesterday that you do have an illness, so that post-traumatic stress, and sometimes the dates and whatnot, you feel a bit jumbled. Can you explain what? We're leaping, and I'm going
to
come back.
Yes, yeah. So like I explained to you yesterday, it's really strange because other lads that I was in the army with and things like that, you know, that haven't got PTSD, and they look back on their time, they know dates, times, and addresses and everything, you know, about when they was in the army. But for me, it's a lot of it's a blur, and I feel like my brain's try blocking it out of other parts of my life that are also like that, that I can sort of that are similar or growing up, you know, there's parts of my life that are missing massively, and I just think that's the brain's coping mechanism of sort of trying to cope with it, basically.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So dates and times for me are quite difficult when it comes down to that.
So we deployed with Three Para to on Op Herrick 13. So Operation Herrick's the kind of code name for the kind of military operations in Afghan at that time. So this is 2010, so the end of 2010.
Yeah.
Can you just explain what was it like when you first arrived?
Yeah.
And then the kind of first week?
So it's 2010, 2011. I'd been in the paras around about a year. Then we got deployed to Afghan. From training with them and sort of bringing my soldiering skills up, once we deployed, landed on the ground, was in Camp Basham for 5 days. And then from there, and up until this point, we were still buzzing, thinking this is going to be great. We're running around with guns, like, you know, all smiles.
Getting to do your job.
Yeah, just all smiles and excited, really. And then on the day that we deployed onto the ground, we was in a Chinook, I think it was late evening. And as we landed, we started hearing the rounds pinging off the side of the Chinook. And then literally landed in a field.
where was that?
Nadi Ali North, Helmand Province. Landed in a field and pushed us out the back, basically, with a pallet of supplies and straight into a contact. And we had to fan out and put all our training straight into practice. And we're straight into a contact. We had to fight our way back to the nearest compound, and that was to be our home for the next 3 months.
And it sounds, because at that time, we went through a period of about 5 years of quite severe fighting in Afghanistan, and you were kind of just coming out the back end, but it was still pretty fierce. And what was day to day life like?
Well, day to day, I think pretty much every day for, it was almost 8 months we was out there, because it got extended by a few weeks. We was pretty much in contact most days, even if it was from anything from a few rounds down to fighting for 6, 7, 8 hours a day. It was horrific. And then instantly, like I said, them smiles soon disappeared. And, you know, and the young lads, there's pictures of us landing at Camp Bastia and all happy and looking like we're going on holiday. And then 8 months later, you're looking at a bunch of men, you know. It's unreal what that much stress can do to the body and how much it can age you and how much it can sort of dull someone's smile. Do you know what I mean? If you want to put it like that. It's intense. It's really, really intense.
There's a book called The English Patient, and they're talking that about the acclimatisation, and they don't talk about weather. You know, it's not about the humidity or the heat or the cold. It's actually about the senses around you and getting accustomed to what's going on. And did you find that? Did you find you become kind of, not like immune to it, but totally desensitised to what your surroundings were?
It's
totally abnormal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just, I sort of feel lied to. You're lied to up until the point where you land on the ground. You're lied to, and you're made to believe that it's a lot easier than what it is, and that, you know, you're going to be okay. You know, we've trained you. It's not enough training that the soldiers get. Basic training and then pre-deployment training, I don't feel is enough to go straight into a war zone like that. Like, that's unreal. Like, we had an exceptional case. Our tour was rough. It was really rough. I've spoken to guys that have been out there and got in 2 contacts in 6 months, you know. But we had it rough. Where the area that we took was particularly rough. I think the Americans tried taking it, and then we got sent in after. And it was just like the business. It was like the hive right in the middle, and we had to fight our way out, basically.
Because you got dropped in.
We got dropped in. Yeah, no, we all got dropped in about 2 kilometres away from each other in our compounds, the whole of Free Power B Company. Over the 3 months, we sort of all joined up and fought our way out and secured the area. But it was unreal, considering the age of... I was one of the oldest.
Yeah.
You know, 21, 20... Oh, no, by the time I got out, I was 23. Some of the lads were like... You know, hadn't lived, hadn't seen anything.
But you talk about training, but these are guys are well trained, well driven, and they're capable individuals, even at 18, 19, 20. Yeah,
physically. Okay. You can train someone physically. You can't train someone mentally for that. Like I say, I feel like we're lied to. In the papers, the media, even the pre-deployment, you know, the sessions you sit in the hall all day and, you know, they're explaining to you what it's like out there. It's just, it's rubbish.
What was it like then? So we talk about contacts, and then I want you to explain, and you can be as graphic or as softer about the approach that you take now, but I just want you to be honest. What was it like with some of the kind of fighting you was doing, and give us some experiences from that and some stories from that?
Like I say, like, you know, sometimes 90% of the time you can't see the enemy. It's a few cracks and bangs and a bit of kicked up dust, and, you know, they're in one ditch and you're in another, 200 meters apart, or they're in another compound, you don't often see them, but there are times, like one of them, I can't remember if it was my 23rd or 24th birthday, we were either side of a road, we got contacted, so we jumped in a ditch, one side of the road, and the road's about 50 meters wide, and they were in the ditch on the other side of the road, and it was like Second World War, like, we were literally fighting over 50 meters. They were in one, we were peeling, trying to get back to our compound, and they were peeling with us, and it was just like in mayhem, absolute mayhem. And it took probably about 2 hours to get about 600 meters of just pure fighting in blistering heat, and with like all your kit on and all your ammunition, and and like you say, it's just young lads. Yeah. That's all it is young lads. Getting told what to do over the radio, basically. Mm. Looking back now, even the sergeants and things like that, they were younger than what I am now.
Yeah, yeah.
To think, it's strange to think I even done it. That's how out of this world it is. Do you know what I mean? Some of the firefights were so intense. It's unreal. Like I said, that was one of the worst ones for me personally, because it was just relentless. Sometimes the contact goes on over a bit of distance, and it's not that.
Was you scared going back to that one?
100%, yeah.
Whilst it's going on?
Yeah, yeah. I think the adrenaline takes over, and it's the same as fighting. You're scared. Nerves are normal. Yeah. If you haven't got nerves, you're not normal. So, yeah, 100% you're scared. Because the dust is kicking up right in front of you, and it's literally a case of a couple of foot or a couple of inches. Mm. And it's like I was saying to you yesterday, I got pinned down out there, and it got extremely close that day.
I mean, this is a crazy story. So can you take us back on that, when you got pinned down?
Yeah.
Take us back like 20 minutes before it happened.
So basically, where our compound was, like I said, we got dropped in, we secured our compound, and then we had to work out from that area. So at the back of our compound that we took over was what we turned into our drop zone or helicopter landing pad. And then at the back of that, there was obviously other fields and other compounds. So we'd patrol out. One day we got contacted, like any other day, and it got extremely close. I was a GPMG gunner, so I was covering.
So you had the big, kind of machine gun.
Yeah, I had the big guns.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was covering everyone, getting back behind the compound for cover. And then we soon realised that there must have been two, we call them sharpshooters because they're not trained to be snipers, but they're as good as snipers. Listen, and this is another thing, they are the best soldiers in the world because they're running around in flip-flops with battered up old guns. And, look, they fought the Russians, the Americans, the English, these guys are good. You're in their back garden, they're in ditches, wearing next to nothing, fighting well-equipped soldiers full of money from all around the world, So anyway, we soon realised there's two sharpshooters. And then so the lads had sort of like got cover behind the compound that I was covering. Every time they sort of stood out to cover me or give me covering fire, the compound would get hit, shot. So they got one sharpshooter covering them and the other one trying to hit me. Because basically, I produce about 80% of the section's firepower, obviously, because I've got the machine gun. They've just got rifles, so they want to hit me. I got pinned down behind a small mound of mud, and I'm getting smashed, and the dust is getting closer and closer.
This is open ground.
Yeah, this is open ground. In front of me is a field. I'm about 20 metres in front of the compound that my guys are behind undercover. But the sharpshooters were so far away that my guys underslung grenade launchers wouldn't reach. So they were just landing midfield or exploding in the air. So it was just me and the sharpshooters, basically.
Were the lads behind you communicating to you and telling
you what's going on? Yeah, we all had helmet cameras as well. Yeah. So that's a really interesting video to watch because you see their view from behind the compound trying to get out to cover me, which they couldn't. And then you see mine. And in that point, going back to being nervous, I was giggling, but not because it was funny, just because I was shitting myself, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Returning fire, and the contact was going on, and my ammunition's getting lower and lower. And then, yeah, I could feel the rounds, how close they were, how extremely close they were. It was like ridiculous. You could hear them. I could feel the thump, and just wasn't quite sure what it was. And I come to my last belt, and I just thought, fuck it, to be honest. Yeah, and you see in the video, it's hilarious. I load my DPMG, slam it down, and I stand up and give it full Rambo. And I let off my last belt. Just like, I just thought, do you know what? Fuck it, if you're going to go, you're going to go, right? And it stopped. Literally, the contact stopped. And then shortly after, we called in an airstrike into the area.
Why did it stop?
Well, this is it. We spoke to the interpreters, and they said it could be a number of things. Likely it is you didn't hit them. Like, yeah. If you'd have seen this video, yeah, you'd realise I didn't hit them. The other one is, like, respect thing, because they respect crazy stuff bravery, like that. Yeah. They respect, like, a warrior type, you know, like someone that's going to stand up and have it. Or they run out of ammunition as well. You know, there's lots of possibilities. But it was really strange. And I was surprised to still be stood there.
So you got back then.
And then I got back behind the compound.
It was about 30, 40 metres behind
Yeah.
And then you went back to your compound.
And then we had to go back because we're all running low on ammunition. We've been there ages. And we called the airstrike in. But it's only getting back, I was sort of trying to drink my water out of my Camelback. Camelback's a water container, holds 3-4 litres.
On your back, like a little rucksack.
Yeah, and that was attached to the side of my my rucksack with ammunition in it. And I was thirsty, obviously been laying in the blistering heat.
How long? Was you in, the fetal position?
Yeah, a couple of hours probably.
Yeah, a couple of hours.
And I was trying to drink my water, and it just wouldn't work. And I got back, and it had holes in it. It had rounds in it, and it's like if you go to the Imperial War Museum, it's actually they made a feature out of it of my kit and my Camelback that had holes in it from how close it was. So it was on my back, and it was obviously the rounds were going over my head and hitting my bag on my back, so 2 inches down. It'd have been straight in between the eyes, but that is how close it gets.
And what was that feeling like? You know, was it almost comical then, or was it serious stuff?
Blue humour? Is that what they call
black humour?
You know, it's like basically there's so much stuff that happens out there that you've got to laugh it off when you're out there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's unreal. You know, you get like 30 minutes on a satellite phone every week or every 2 weeks or whatever it is. I can't remember. And like you'd be on the phone to home and then you're getting a contact and you've got to go. And it's just crazy stuff like that. So when you speak to people back home, they're like, they're distraught. But to you, like you say, you're out there a few weeks, it becomes normal.
You're more in control. But something you're not in control as you, because you was a medic as well, was the casualties that
I was medic trained. Yeah, I think like we're all medic trained.
Yeah,
Or like one person out of each section's medic trained.
So what was you, because that's out of your control. So what was the... What was you dealing with regards to that?
Sorry. Excuse me. So one of the instances that happened out there, one of the, which I see as the main cause to my PTSD, to be honest, one of the things I have the worst nightmares about and really gives me the jitters, like, is... So an IED went off one day, a big bang, local to our compound. And then we looked on the cameras and basically all the locals were sort of rushing towards us. We've gone out there to see them. And two kids had just been wandering around near where our compound. And at the time they were similar age to my daughters, which are back home in England. And then all the lads, by the time I've got out there, all the lads are running back with one of these kids, the youngest one, and then so I've gone back out to this 7-seater people carrier thing, and there's another kid there, so I've picked him up on my own, running, and then we started treating these kids. Basically, one of them's completely in half, the youngest one, and the lad I started dealing with had like a lump out of his head, he's balls were blown off, basically. He was in bits, do you know what I mean? Like, in real rag. And he was screaming. The youngest one was, like, completely out of his alive. Well, his heart was still going. But was, like, completely out of it. And the one and the older one was screaming, which is the worst.
The family, you know.
We don't know. Yeah, it's one of them. You know what I mean? Yeah. And to be honest, in that situation, you're just trying to treat them to keep them alive. Do you know what I mean? And we spent a lot of time trying to treat them.
How old were they?
I think one was about 5, and one was about 8 or something
like
that.
No wonder you have nightmares.
Young. Do you know what I mean? And basically, we try treating them and keeping them alive as long as possible, with the skills that we knew.
Yeah.
And then eventually, a helicopter took them, but we later found out that they died. Do you know what I mean? We knew they died. Do you know what I mean? But yeah. It's just you can't give up. You're not allowed to give up.
Because I know you. There was kind of 3 sections to this tour. There was. You took a compound and secured it in Nadi Ali North, and then you moved out. What did you feel like towards the locals? What was your feelings as an individual, but also as a team as well?
You build up a bit of a... Because obviously we'd gone through that. You get a bit of an emotional connection to the area and the people. You learn to trust certain people, do you know what I mean? And you recognise faces and that. You're out there for a long time. I think you're roughly about 3 months... was in the first place, and then we got orders to move on, which is absolutely ridiculous. And you can imagine the frustration of the hours, the blood, sweat and tears that we'd put into taking this certain area, kicking people out of their homes and taking over their compounds and stuff like that, just to be told to move on was really annoying.
Did you feel like you betrayed the people around you as a personal level?
Not so much, more just selfishly pissed off. Like that someone sitting in an office is you know, all right, you've done your job, move on. It's like, well, no, common sense, as soon as we go, the fields where we were rife, it is just pure opium and pure weed. Snoop Dogg would be in heaven. It's literally I've never seen weed like it. Do you know what I mean? It is,
and that's why this area was such a important strategic.
I assume so. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. They really wanted this area. Do you know what I mean? And just to be told just to leave it back to them,
mate. Well, I'm gonna jump us quite a bit now, and I'm sure the book will get released at some point. The film, it sounds like, but I'm gonna jump us, and I'm gonna. You arrived back summer 2011. And things weren't quite right.
Yeah.
And I want you to take it from there, really. What was going on?
So, when I got back, there was talks of me going on selection, Special Forces selection. Like I said, up to this point, I felt like a super soldier. I give everything my 100%. I'd smash everything physically in terms of being a soldier. I left Free Para and went back to the Irish Guards. I got asked to leave Free Para, or it sort of come to the end of my stint with Free Para, got sent back to the Irish Guards, and I think they sussed it out in Free Para that something weren't quite right, do you know what I mean? I was never a problem. I was always 100% getting stuck in. I just come back with a different attitude, I think. And then by the time I got to the Irish Guards, I noticed something wasn't right. I was having a lot of nightmares, I was stressing, I was kicking off, I was fighting, wasn't myself.
Well,
I was always drinking.
Was you?
Yeah, okay. It's part of army lifestyle. We'd drink every night till 4 or 5 in the morning, go on a 8-mile run at 7 in the morning to sober up. Do you know what I mean? It's that was just part of our life.
It was a culture.
But a lot of the lads I was with are exactly the same, especially in our section. None of us really come back the same. And at that point, I think in the January, I got asked to go to see a medic or go to the med centre. And then I was chatting with a guy for 30 minutes and he said, you're not allowed to go back to the barracks. And that was it. And it was at that point I realised something was wrong in terms of noticing how different I was to before the tour and after, you know. I'd lost all sort of respect for hierarchy because of the orders. What we got given in Afghan were just total crap. And, you know, obviously the nightmares, the stress and things like that when I come back, I just didn't feel like soldiering anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Was the alcohol helping?
No, I don't really put I wouldn't really put a label on that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I wouldn't say I started hitting the drink anymore than I ever have done. I was just a young lad. You know, obviously we was drinking because we hadn't drunk for eight months. Yeah. But yeah, nothing like, you know, I wasn't waking up in the morning and having a can of Tennent's or anything like that.
Yeah,
okay, yeah, I recognise them signs, trust me.
Yeah, exactly. So transition then. So you're now in a period of, you've kind of lost everything that you've been working towards, and you said you've become disillusioned, and you've just spent 8 months in possibly the most stressful situation anyone could be in. I mean, this was contact every single day, and there was fighting all the time.
Yeah.
But what you're explaining is quite typical of a lot of people out there, guys and girls, who have had these experiences of trauma in one tour where it's just been like rammed in.
Yeah.
And now you've got to deal with the aftermath. And what was the support mechanism like with the military? How were you getting treated for this? So you've been diagnosed, and what's now the treatment?
This is the problem. So before I realised I had PTSD, if someone had said to me, "Oh, I've got PTSD," I'd be like, "Man, the fuck up. Mm. What's wrong with you?" Do you know what I mean? But until you've got it and until you suffer with it, you don't realise the implications it has on your life. Like, I was literally the worst. I'd have been the worst person. Do you know what I mean? Man up, like, you know, get on with it.
Yeah.
But then when it started really hitting me, you really noticed the effects it has. I was shitting myself driving down the road, potholes and things like that. Like, because you'd go into a daydream of driving and then you see a pothole out the corner of your eye and you'd flinch and you'd just think, it's crazy, do you know what I mean? And it felt like, because when I went back to the Irish Guards, they were in Aldershot, and it felt like every time I went to Aldershot, it'd get worse. Like, my senses would get heightened, and I'd put on my uniform in the morning, and it would change me.
Who was just supporting you through this?
There wasn't. This is what I'm saying in terms of being told to man the fuck up. Basically, there was no support. When we come back, we had like a group chat. Everyone's all right, aren't they?
Of course, yeah.
And to be honest, that was the only trouble with free power, as in you expected to be rough and you expected to be tough and you expected to get on with it. Where I think we sat down, I think the company sergeant major sat on a bench. It was like, everyone's all right, aren't they?
Yeah.
It was one of them. And obviously, especially me being me and being the Jack the lad and being the boy, I'm not going to go wild, to be honest.
And you didn't want to seem to be weak as well.
Exactly. Do you know what I mean? And then obviously the weaker lads aren't going to admit that in front of the other lads because they get told to man the fuck up. Do you know what I mean? So it's hard.
So there was no... I'm just surmising this.
Yeah.
So there's no support. You're not going for regular counselling post. So after you've been diagnosed with...
After I got diagnosed, they sent me to get treatment.
Yeah.
Hand-eye coordination treatment, which they basically wave a finger in front of your eye and tell you to talk about it. Well, to be honest, I could have strangled this geezer because he's sitting there telling me he knows exactly how I feel. And he looked like he'd never been out of an office in his life, so he didn't know how I felt. I sort of had to walk away from it, to be honest, and tried to deal with it on my own.
You did try and deal with it by yourself, but eventually you got out.
Yeah.
So you were discharged.
Before I got medically discharged, I got told that I weren't allowed to go near any army barracks or anything like that. And they were still paying me for a while.
Who told you that?
It's just come down from like hierarchy that I wasn't allowed to go to Aldershot.
Was you at home?
Yeah, basically. Just left at home. Yeah, so, and at that point, I was just angry because I wanted to be in the army, 22 years, get it done, smash it out of the way, retire early, do you know what I mean? Go into the fire service or something like that. I had my life planned out around being in the army because I knew if I wasn't in the army, I'm going back to this lifestyle where I'm going to end up locked up or dead. And the army, when I joined the army, I had it all planned, I had it set and, you know, so when it all went wrong, I sort of fell apart a little bit, and I I'm not ashamed to say that there was at times where I just thought, fuck this, do you know what I mean? I'd rather be dead, and I was in a really bad way. And because in my family, I'm sort of alpha male in my family.
Yeah, yeah.
And really feel like, and I'm not going to go to mum, go, mum, I feel like I want to kill myself. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I felt so on my own, and you know, there was a bit of embarrassment where I sort of didn't want to admit to people that I was in this bad position. So anyway, I walked into a gym in Windsor, met my now coach, Dean Amazinger, who's an MMA coach and like a sports scientist guy. I started training and I was just this big, angry, really strong, really fit lump. And I signed up for an interclub fight and they said, oh, you do know, you know, these guys have been training, this, that and the other. I said, yeah, just put my name down and ended up having an interclub fight, which is you're fighting people from the same gym, basically, but just a bit more of an intense atmosphere in the cage, people watching and stuff like that. And this guy had been doing it, I think, I said, signed me up to a K1 or a Muay Thai fight. So it's basically standing, kicking and punching.
Yeah.
And got in there and just, like, give him everything I had. And pretty much won the fight. And he was hitting me and I just kept coming forward. It was one of them.
Yeah, yeah. Was it a release for you, was it?
Oh, massively, yeah. Like, because I love fighting anyway. And I love everything physical. And obviously, because since the army have just said, don't come in, like, I needed to do something physical. So anyway, I walked out the cage, Dean turned around and just said, I can't teach that. Like, what you've got, I can't teach. I can teach you the skills, but the terms of the heart, and I can't teach you that.
Mm.
So stick around. And then that's where my MMA career started.
And that's when you kind of found it, your feet really, and got that kind of family, was part of that team again, the training, the focus, you were one-on-one, you were getting that praise, you were getting all that, what you craved.
Yeah.
Again, I'm just going to jump a little bit. You turned pro in 2015.
Yeah.
Is that when it started getting serious for you? As in, like, I'm a fighter, look, I've got my background.
What? Everything does happen for a reason, and I was getting paid from the army. Although they were paying me and I weren't going into work, it gave me the time to train MMA. And there's no money in MMA. Like, I'm on my second world title and I'm still scraping now. Do you know what I mean? There's not a lot of money in it until you get to the very top. So it did give me that freedom to train. And like I say, and then I went pro in 2015. At that point, I thought, I can make it. My coaches always said, oh, you know, you can make it to the top. And you think, you know, they know I like praise.
Yeah.
And I thought they were just like praising me, do you know what I mean? Just so I do well. But it's becoming more and more apparent that actually I can make it to the top.
Is this, you talk about Castell, we're going to come on to it in a second, actually, because I think it's relevant. I think it's going to resonate with a lot of people. Was this helping you with a control mechanism, because you've still got
PTSD,
and it with the exercise and that love of that team around you. And I know you've got some amazing people supporting you from your wife and your family and that kind of wider family with the team now. Was that a good control mechanism for you?
Yeah, 100%. It is. I don't know what I'd have done without MMA, to be honest with you. And like I say, being part of that family, being part of that unit, being part of that physical toughness is a massive if I don't train for a week, my wife literally will send me out of the house send me to the gym because she's like, you need, because it sends me nuts. I start getting really stressed, I start getting really anxious. I can't watch certain things on telly. If I watch the news or I watch a military type film, it just set me back 5 years to, you know, we've been through some tough times, me and my wife, really bad. You know, I punched her in my sleep and I used to fit out in my sleep, scream, wake up crying.
Can you just go
sweating
back? What do you mean you punched her in her
sleep? Oh, I didn't just punch her in her sleep for not cooking my dinner. It was like, in terms of just having really bad
nightmares. You was asleep and you was having nightmares and you was inadvertently.
I'd lash out in my sleep.
Yeah, got you.
You know, we've been through some really tough times, and I'd wake up after a rough night of having nightmares and stuff like that and take it out on her and just be an arsehole, basically. Yeah. Be moody and be stressed all day. And
do you speak to her about the kind of experiences you've gone through?
We have done. When I first got back from Afghan and my family noticed that something was wrong with me, I actually showed them I tried explaining to them some of the situations that I explained to you, and I've showed them some of my helmet camera stuff, and they shut the laptop and said, don't ever show anyone that ever again, and don't ever watch it yourself. It's like, it's that hideous.
What have you, are you going, I know you've got this, the MMA stuff, are you going through any kind of formal, it's not the word, therapy now?
No.
Do you need it? Do you think you need it?
Yeah, I'll go through stages. Like after this and after this week, we've been talking about it a lot. It's going to be probably a tough couple of weeks for me. It's like when something's made more apparent to me, if I watch a film, it resonates with me a lot, or I have to talk, you know, I don't often talk about it, but you know, now we're talking about it, I'll probably have a rough couple of nights. I'll be thinking about it a lot. It'll be on the front of my mind. But no, I sometimes I do feel like I need treatment. I tried getting a hold of the NHS. My doctor referred me to someone else. They referred me to someone else. Told me they were going to ring me back. They didn't ring me back. So when I rang my doctor, they referred me to the same person and they didn't know who I was again.
Yeah.
So, and then by the time I felt like I kept chasing it 2-3 weeks later, I was like, I felt okay again. Do you know, it comes in stints. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You deal with it and it fades out again. Do you know what I mean?
There was, in this community, hero gets banded around it, bravery gets banded around it, and I personally think this is brave, you talking about this, because I know this is going to help somebody, but like one person, this is going to help, yeah. I guarantee it. Trevor Colt, who won the Military Cross from his time in Afghan, he posted a video on social media the other day. It was one of the bravest things I've ever seen, and definitely the bravest thing I've seen on social media, and he talked about his PTSD coming back. Like, he campaigns tirelessly, he lives off a war pension, campaigns tirelessly for veteran welfare, and he just said he was so stressed that the way he's explaining it was, it was like someone had come through the door that he didn't want in the room with him. He cried on the video, and I thought, fuck, I was like, that is brave. And that is what I'm going to go on to next, part of post-traumatic growth, because even though he's in the midst of it, in the midst of it, like, he understands and appreciates that he's developed because of it, and he's still got to help somebody else, even when he's in it. And what you're talking about this, and I think it's great, your story, and again this could be a 5-hour podcast, but your growth, what are you seeing from the there must be positives from this.
Yeah,
you've mentioned a few already, but what are you seeing now where you can actually, my experiences in trauma in conflict. How are you growing? How have you grown because of it?
You know, everyone has something in their life that pushes them in a certain direction, or, you know, makes them grow in a certain way. For me personally, it's made me tough. I've had to be tough. Yeah. I've had to be durable. And it's put, for me personally, obviously it shaped my fighting career. I go into an MMA fight with not a worry in the world. I'm not getting shot, I'm not getting blown up, I haven't got to worry about any of my friends getting injured. I'm just going in there and I'm doing what I love to do, and it's made me mentally strong in that aspect of things. Do you know what I mean? Other aspects I feel mentally weak, in terms of where I can't control my emotions sometimes, I can't control my subconscious, you know, I can't control what happens in my sleep and stuff like this.
That is a sign of strength though as well, because you've been through so much, you've done so much of this, like, strong stuff.
You know, in terms of other aspects of life, like normal life, which a normal person would leave that hasn't seen this sort of stuff, I find so easy. Do you know what I mean? In terms of just dealing with, it puts things into perspective.
That's you're cutting loads of weight now, and I know your body's going through a bit of stress.
Yeah,
I've never done it, but I know, like, what the conversation I had you before we recorded. Your body's going through a lot of stress, but you're not crouched down behind a mound in the middle of Afghanistan getting shot at. If I was one of your opponents now, and I'm not really too bothered about them at the moment, and we haven't got into the MMA so much, but if I was someone who was fighting you, I'd be like, I can't take this guy anywhere. Yeah. Where can I take this guy?
Well, to be honest, the commentators have said it a couple of times, like, you need to realise this guy will not give up.
Yeah.
You're going to have to kill him.
And that didn't happen often.
Nah.
You know what I mean? Like, as in, you're on it.
I've had a lot of close calls, believe me, in Afghan, and
the time in the cage now is all about fun, and
100%,
maybe we're gonna have to wrap it up, and But is anything what's happening right now? I know you got your fight on Thursday, York Hall, and that's your second world.
Yeah, lightweight world title. Obviously won the welterweight world title about 5 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're on the up, and watch out.
I know you've been supported by a few veteran-owned companies. My company's done a little bit, but also Lion Air Conditioning that helped you out a little bit as well with this. I think it's really important the community does get together.
100%, yeah.
And it is thriving at the moment. People are really collectively.
And do you know what? I'm always on my social media if anyone wants to chat or just ask a question. I'm here to help. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, if you're going through what I'm going through or been through, get in touch and let's chat. So.
Let's leave it there.